So many people around the world agree that whistleblowers are a necessary component of a functioning democracy. Human nature is such that every country needs truth tellers who can stand up to those in authority and to expose waste, fraud, abuse, illegality, or threats to the public health or public safety. But what happens when a country simply doesn't have a culture of whistleblowing? Or what happens when there are whistleblowers but there are no laws to protect them? We're going to tell you how those laws are written and implemented. And it may not be the way that you think. I'm John Kiriakou, and you're watching The Whistleblowers. Most people have never heard of the Australia-based non-governmental organization Blueprint for Free Speech. Blueprint for Free Speech was founded in 2014 by Dr. Soulette Dreyfus, and it almost immediately became one of the most important repositories in the world for research, draft legislation, and international activism on behalf of whistleblowers. Blueprint for Free Speech is responsible for successful whistleblower protection legislation in countries all around the world, and it works closely with other whistleblower organizations and with governments to tailor that legislation to each locale. We're happy to be joined by the executive director and founder of Blueprint for Free Speech, Dr. Soulette Dreyfus. Dr. Dreyfus's career has spanned academia, journalism, and advocacy. She's a specialist in cybersecurity technologies and in integrity systems that work as corrective mechanisms in society. Her work at Blueprint has been to improve the standards of laws and practices all around the world that protect freedom of expression. And she has raised the standards for whistleblower protection everywhere. She also works on projects to protect the media's ability to publish freely, particularly via the internet, and on the creation of new technologies to achieve those goals. Welcome, Dr. Soulette Dreyfus. Let's start at the beginning. You've been interested in whistleblower and free speech issues for a long time. You were even one of the co-founders of WikiLeaks with Julian Assange. How did this all begin for you? When did it become a passion?
So my background was originally as a journalist. I trained on one of the largest daily newspapers in Australia became a fully fledged staff reporter and then got my own beat there. And as part of that, I started to do more investigative journalism work. And I really began to understand the role of the whistleblower and its importance, not only in that work, but in the public interest element of journalism in particular. And so that's how I sort of came into this setting. And it became clear to me that whistleblowers, at least at that stage, 20, you know, some odd years ago, were treated very, very badly. I mean, today we talk about them being treated badly in many instances, and they are. But back then, it was a case of complete ignorance and very few protections in law. Very few countries had any protection. Even in the U.S., which had some of the earliest whistleblower legislation, was very narrowly scoped. You know, is it fraud in a U.S. government contract as opposed to broader society protection? And so those reasons were how I sort of got into this and decided it was a very important field to actually work in.
And what was your progression? Did you begin as a journalist and then move to academia? And along the way, how did your activism come into play?
So I've always had a bit of the activism about me. My mother told me from an early age that I had a strong sense of righteousness and indignation for injustice. So I think that was always part of it and was perhaps one reason I had gone into journalism was to report information, but to report information that was meaningful to people, particularly about wrongdoing, about things like corruption. I went into academia because having worked in journalism for a while and first on a daily paper and then on a magazine in the tech space and then doing freelance and then having written a book with Julian Assange, I decided that, you know, the progression of moving from a 400-word story to a 4,000-word feature to, you know, 40,000-plus words working on a book, it was actually time to be able to delve into doing lots of primary research. And you really need to go kind of into academia to be able to have the resources and the time to do that. Also, I quite like the idea of teaching because I could see that there were really giant gaps in knowledge out there. And so I teach whistleblowing as part of my subjects, including, for example, a subject on cybersecurity and digital privacy, where we talk about the difference between insider threat to an organization in a cybersecurity sense and actually whistleblowing, which is not there to destroy the organization, but rather there to save it. So that's sort of how I got into the academic side of it, and it's been quite rewarding.
There are a lot of whistleblower organizations out there. Here in the United States, we have the Government Accountability Project, the National Whistleblower Center, the Whistleblower and Source Protection Organization, and countless others. And around the world, there are chapters of Transparency International and other groups. But Blueprint for Free Speech is different. It focuses on legislation that would provide long-term relief and a legal framework to help whistleblowers rather than on short-term aid. How did you come up with the idea? And why do you think nobody has done something like this before?
So I think a number of the groups like GAP do give feedback on draft legislation, but maybe they aren't necessarily the instigators of it. And part of it was, in a sense, my sort of academic training. When I looked at this problem and thought, wow, it's really important to help whistleblowers who have got difficult cases. And that is something that, you know, we should never ignore. But if you don't address the underlying structural problem, which is they're not protected in law, and that includes in regulation, also implementation of the law, then you've got this huge, you know, problem of perpetually putting out bushfires. Wherever you go, there are going to be whistleblowers who have stood up, who have revealed wrongdoing. And that's a good thing, that element of human nature that causes them to recognize wrongdoing and speak out about it. I always find that, in a sense, quietly reassuring that humans somewhere still have that element of them. And so that's great. But you've got to fix it at a fundamental level if you really want change at scale. And so that's how we came about to do it. So we do research into what is the legislation in various countries and how can it be changed. And we take a really wraparound approach to changing the environment, the whole ecosystem for whistleblowers. And that means analysis and research of the legislation and in practice. Law reform, which is actually, you know, proposing new laws or changing laws, but it's also things like creating tools for whistleblowers. In our case, we do digital tools. So we do Ricochet Refresh, which is a free and open source software. It runs on a desktop, Mac, Windows, Linux, and it allows, for example, a journalist and a whistleblower to chat to each other online, where both of them are not only chatting securely, they're chatting anonymously. So it means that a whistleblower can contact a journalist anonymously and give them information and file transfer anonymously, technologically anonymously, not just a fake email account on Gmail, and continue that conversation. So let's say that a whistleblower has actually disclosed a set of major documents that could be thousands of pages. Well, the journalist isn't going to know where to look. They need to be able to come back and say to the whistleblower, you know, what am I looking for here? And the whistleblower goes, oh, it's on page 723 at the bottom, didn't you know? But that ongoing conversation is really important to be able to weed through the masses of information that we all generate and that inevitably will, you know, get disclosed because they're part of bigger documents. It's also true for anti-fraud agencies. So increasingly in Europe, that sort of technology of the anonymous Dropbox is being used by government agencies in order to receive anonymous disclosures because they understand it's very risky for whistleblowers. And in a sense, the focus should be on what the disclosure is of the wrongdoing, not who the person is who's actually making it. And then we have a new free software project called Gosling. And this is quite interesting because we've, again, gone deeper into the systemic problems. And so it's not just an end user piece of software. It's a piece of software for software developers. And what it does is it allows you, if you write a software application, whether it's a chat program or a file program or storage or IoT, whatever it is, to easily plug in Tor to that software. What does that mean? You've just added the functionality of anonymity to the software. Now, that's actually usually quite difficult to do. It's not very easy to plug into Tor. It's very risky. You have to study a lot to figure out how to do it properly. If you don't do it properly, then the anonymity won't be preserved. And then there's a risk that people think they're transferring information anonymously and they're not. But by doing this, by making it sort of plug and play, we hope that it will actually expand the amount of anonymity that is available to software developers, and therefore eventually to, in a sense, seed all of the software applications that whistleblowers and journalists might consider using.
I'm proud to say that I've been associated with you and with Blueprint since 2015, and that we did some good work together getting a new whistleblower protection law passed in Greece. One of the things that amazed me when I first met you was how much success you had already had elsewhere around the world. You've been able to help governments enact new legislation in countries as disparate and diverse as Canada, Zambia, the Czech Republic, and Jamaica. There are many, many more. How do you do that? Do governments approach you, or do you proactively offer up a template of new legislation?
So typically we will approach, we might get whistleblower reports from cases on the ground. We'll approach a set of NGOs or other civil society groups, academics in particular countries, and build, work with them to build an ecosystem. So we don't just sort of waltz in over the top and say, you have to do it this way. Because although there's some common threads that you want to be in every piece of whistleblower legislation to protect the whistleblower, there are a number of components that really vary by the culture of the country. So in the United States, paying whistleblowers who reveal serious corruption, a portion, if you will, of the savings, for example, to government, is something that is comfortably embedded into aspects of American society. That culturally is quite foreign, for example, to the culture in the UK, and it wouldn't be a fit, many people feel, in the UK to their whistleblower structures there. So that's just dependent on what the culture is of the country. And you have to be really sensitive to that fact. You can't just waltz in over the top. So, for example, in Spain, we've been very active in bringing together a number of different NGOs and members of society that care about this topic, and that might be criminology professors or law professors. It might be consumer groups who are caring about whether or not there are flaws in high chairs or baby seats in cars, that you need to have a safe avenue to be able to report those things so they get fixed. Or it might be a financial institution, for example, a regulator in the finance area who wants to know when a bank is doing the wrong thing. And so we try to bring them together in coalitions. It doesn't always work. They don't always get along, but and then try and find the common ground between them. And from that, we sort of bubble it up from the ground up and take that usually in a series of roundtables and discussions to the relevant bureaucrats who are involved in decision-making. Often it's a department or Ministry of Justice, but it may be in some other area. And then we involve the politicians in the process. So it's a long haul. We, for example, had a contribution to Ukraine's first whistleblower protection law, and that was passed a few years ago. And that was done with a number of civil society groups. And that is an example of what you can do if you do this over a long haul period of time.
Thank you, Dr. Sulette Dreyfus. Don't go away. You're watching The Whistleblowers. We're going to take a short break and then continue our conversation with our guest, Dr. Sulette Dreyfus.
In 1834, France invaded Algeria, and straightaway the French started inhabiting it to strengthen their position. The colonists, known as Pieds Noirs, took the best land. From day one, the local population was put into an unequal position and was brutally exploited. This caused mass discontent. The people of Algeria began their long-term fight for independence. In 1954, the banner of freedom was raised by the National Liberation Front. A guerrilla war against the occupants broke out. The French tried to suppress the rebellion using cruel measures. Whole villages were wiped out. Acts of torture and executions of civil people, including pregnant women, children, and old people, took place. More than 2 million people were put into concentration camps. However, these punitive measures didn't help. The Algerian patriots managed to induce France to start peace negotiations. In 1962, Evian Accords were signed, putting Algeria on the path towards independence. But this was achieved at a colossal price. Algeria, by rights, is considered to be a country of martyrs. According to the calculations of historians, the French colonists are responsible for the deaths of 1.5 million Algerians.
Welcome back to The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou, and we're speaking with Dr. Solette Dreyfus. She's a professor, journalist, activist, and the founder and executive director of the NGO Blueprint for Free Speech. Welcome back, Dr. Dreyfus. I want to ask you about financing. So many whistleblower organizations here in the U.S. have big plans but small budgets. They mean well, and indeed they help a lot of people, but they just don't have the budgets necessary to make a major impact on things like legislation. I know that Blueprint partners with other organizations to get projects done. You also have had success with foundations around the world. Can you tell us about some of your partnerships?
Yeah, I mean, we, you know, almost all of our funding is done on a project basis because we don't have an endowment. And it is hard, you know, you are scraping and applying for grant rounds, competitive grant rounds every day. You know, I will get off this interview and I will go work on yet another grant application, which is unfortunate because I'd really like to spend that half of my time I spend on this doing the work instead. But fortunately, we have other good people in the organization who can do that. So the kinds of grants we've had, for example, we've had some a number of European Commission competitive grants. We've won. Those are often over sort of a longer period, 2-3 years. And those have been partnering with a set of civil society groups. So we will typically reach out to 3, 4, 5, 6, in some cases more than 10 different countries, civil society groups, and say, okay, let's try and do this in a way that works for, you know, is multipliable across a set of countries. And we've got a project we're working on at the moment, which is to actually train lawyers to better defend journalists, activists, academic researchers against slap cases. So those are, in a sense, vexatious litigation that's not really designed to win. It's just designed to muzzle people from reporting, for example, on their research. And that's across 11 countries. So those are the kinds of things. We sometimes get private foundations where we apply and, you know, we ask, will you fund us to do this particular project for the next year? The great news is that I have not found that any of the funders who we've dealt with to date have been in any way interfering. They've all been very hands-off. And we wouldn't work with a funder who was super interfering because it's not what we're on about. But they just want to know that you are actually doing the job, and then they see that we're actually doing the job, and that's fine. But we have total freedom, and I insist on that. We have total freedom in how we go about it and what we're recommending.
Another thing that I've always admired about Blueprint for Free Speech is that you produce a great number of scholarly reports. You make those reports available to the public for free on your website, as well as your draft whistleblower legislation. That is certainly unselfish. Tell us about the decision to do that. What results have you seen?
It's great, actually. You know, so we, for example, partnered with another civil society group in Europe to develop a set of reports across certain countries. And then we've had it in both of our libraries, which is great. Those reports have actually been used by a whole set of people. I get emails from universities in the US, from the Midwest, who are going, oh, wow, we had no idea this resource was there. You know, I'm going to actually give it to my class of law students. So I've had law professors doing it. I've had people who bureaucrats who have been the secretarial role or the secretariat role in parliamentary committees come and say, wow, this is a really great resource. But we've done that because we think it's very important to do it through the lens of whistleblower protection. Right. So there are a lot of country reports you can get out there about this country and that country, but they're not through the lens of whistleblower protection. And often the whistleblower protections that exist in society are not in one single piece of legislation. We recommend that it is because you find better outcomes when it is centrally located in one piece of legislation. But very frequently, it's in a piece of labor law or consumer law or some other piece of, or could even be in digital rights law, some other piece of legislation where you've kind of pieced it together and you'll draw, okay, well, bureaucrats can get that protection from this corner, you know, and so it's a bit messy. So by bringing them all together in one place, in one report, for example, a solicitor who's got a whistleblower knocking on their door for the first time doesn't really know much about the legislation and go, right, okay, it's this six pieces of legislation. Here are the groups that are involved in it. These are the existing cases that I need to go study. And he or she can ramp up really quickly to help the whistleblower on the ground in that country.
Can you tell us about the countries around the world that are making real progress on whistleblower protections? And what countries do you think are backsliding? Are you seeing any trends?
We've been reasonably happy with where Spain is going. And initially it's been a bit of a hard slog. The Spanish government was pretty closed in their approach. They were not really including civil society. We kept politely knocking on the door. Finally, they agreed to have a set of roundtables, although with very short notice. And then eventually, more than a year after the due date from the European directive that was passed to protect whistleblowers was supposed to be implemented in national law, they have actually released a draft piece of legislation, which has some weaknesses, but there are a lot of strengths in it as well. So I'm quietly optimistic that that piece of legislation will go through late, but hopefully pretty good by the end, pretty good coverage. Certainly it's important. It's the first time that Spain will have passed any whistleblower legislation at the federal level. Spain has had a number of problems with corruption, and therefore it's really important that this legislation both exists and is reasonably robust. So I'd say in my hopeful category, they'd be kind of leading the charge. Australia has been a great disappointment in its whistleblower legislation. So I was involved in the initial first ever federal legislation that was passed in Australia back in 2013. Now that was for public servants, but we've had now a number of high profile cases of whistleblowers in the public service who have not been able to use that legislation to protect themselves. And that's partially because of carve-outs that were insisted on being put in there by a set of politicians, cabinet members at the time. We objected to them. They pushed them through anyway. We were hopeful that this last couple of weeks, a judge in the ACT court might go ahead and rule on an important case that it did apply. Unfortunately, they ruled the wrong way, and now the case will go ahead against that whistleblower. That case is sub judice, so I won't go into a lot of detail about it, but the allegation that the whistleblower has made is around war crimes against the special unit within the Australian military overseas. So it's very serious allegations, and it's been supported by a report that was done by a judge who is also a military officer who did an independent evaluation of the situation. So I'd say in the kind of downward trajectory basket, Australia leads the charge there. The Attorney General here has recognized that the whistleblower legislation is not fit for purpose and needs to be overhauled. And in fact, He personally intervened when this Labour government took power some months ago in one of the major whistleblower cases, that of Bernard Collaery. And this is a case that Blueprint had been agitating for a number of years. And the charges were dropped against him, which was great. But they have not extended this to other whistleblowers in the pipeline, including, for example, a tax office whistleblower who whistleblew on something that's really fundamentally important. And that is that proper policies and checks and balances are actually adhered to before the tax office reaches into the individual citizen's bank account and garnishes wages because they've decided that you owe, you know, them money. Regardless of whether or not an individual does or doesn't, you really want to make sure there is severe, you know, oversight and checks and balances on that, because obviously that power is immense. And those weren't being followed, according to the whistleblower. They had just been pushed to the side. So those I would say are, in a sense, the comparison countries. Not all of the countries in Europe have actually implemented the whistleblower protection directive that was passed in 2019 in Europe. Now, that was supposed to have been done 2 years after it was passed, which was, I think, about November. And that's unfortunate. There are a set of reasons why I think that is. Some governments didn't fully understand the power of whistleblowing legislation. And Blueprint was involved in getting that EU directive passed. So when the Parliament in Europe passes the legislation, it's binding in that there's a clock ticking on when the national parliaments must then make their own version of the legislation that adheres to all the ticker boxes and pass it in their own law in the, you know, in a way that's compatible with their own law structure. So there are still a number of countries that haven't done that yet. And, you know, we can only watch a few of them, but other NGOs are watching other ones because of limited resourcing. But I think it is something that's really important for some resourcing to go into, because if we get this right in 27 countries in Europe, the pressure on the rest of the world to actually do this consistently is high. And that's something we hope to see. In a sense, that European directive becomes the standard that the rest of the world's legislation in countries that don't currently have whistleblower legislation, for example, many countries in Asia, that becomes the standard that they really have to adhere to. And that's good, because it's a reasonably good standard. Yes, okay, there's some things in it we'd like a little bit more of, but in the scheme of things, it's a reasonably good standard.
Thank you to our guest, Dr. Soulette Dreyfus. That's all we have for you today. I'm John Kiriakou, and this has been The Whistleblowers.